So my talk is on special chanting. The first Sunday of every month in the morning, we do special chanting, Kwansam Bosal chanting, Jijong Bosal chanting. In the Kwannon school in the past, special chanting has also included Thousand Eyes and Hands chant, which is in our chanting book, but I don't know that we've done that in a while. That was very interesting what Paul pointed out in his talk on the Great Dharani, that in the middle of there, in the middle of Thousand Eyes and Hands Sutra is the Great Dharani. And I didn't believe it. I went back and saw it. I thought it was amazing. But the handouts start with the notes to this edition section. So this is from the Kansas Zen Center's chanting book, where Stanley Lombardo, I guess it has, maybe with some help, word for word translated a lot of the sutras that aren't translated in the back of our chanting book. And so there are some word for word translations of the Kwansam Bosal chant from that chanting book here. It's interesting. He's one of the people that points out or states that the Great Dharani is not translated because those are just efficacious sounds and they don't have word for word translations. So I appreciate Paul's efforts to find the word for word translations. And it's interesting the fact that they do exist learning about those, it did seem to refer to a lot of kind of non-Buddhist spiritual tradition. And so maybe that's why we just sort of ignore that part of it and say that it doesn't have a word-for-word meaning. So just going through the Kwansam Bosal chant, we have this kind of intro homage to the three jewels. And then it leads into the Kwansam Bosal chant that is repeated. And so this is definitely, John was talking about how the Diamond Sutra and some of these Wisdom Sutra chants seem to have the function of perpetuating this verbal tradition and remembering the doctrine. But other chants are more having to do with mantra or dharanis, as Paul had described for the Great Dharani. And this seems to be definitely more the latter. It's more of a mantra or dharani type chant. After exiting out of the repetition of Kwansam Bosal, there are a number of things that are identified as mantras and dharanis here that aren't translated word for word. So that's the basic of what's in the chant. And of course, for Jijong Bosal chanting, we just substitute Jijong Bosal for Kwansam Bosal. After that, you recognize here, this is the stanza from the homage to the three jewels that recognizes these four main bodhisattvas. So one of the other things that came out of John's talk on the Diamond Sutra was it seemed like there was a lot of explication of this traditional distinction between this kind of a person who seeks enlightenment for their own sake, and is that the arhat, I guess, and there are these other categories of people who seek after enlightenment, but then there's the bodhisattva ideal, which is seeking to gain enlightenment for all beings, and not passing over into nirvana until everybody has the opportunity to be, or all beings have a chance to be enlightened. So that's kind of a down-to-earth description of what a bodhisattva is, but then somewhere along the line there came this idea of these four celestial saint-like mythical bodhisattvas, and they're listed here from the Amitsha, the Three Jewels. And what I've done then is found a bunch of information about each of them and described them. I mostly did cut and paste from Wikipedia to talk about sort of the iconography and what the bodhisattvas are associated with. So there's Manjushri, which is the bodhisattva of wisdom, Prajna wisdom, and there's a description of how he's depicted as a male bodhisattva wielding a flaming sword in his right hand, typically cutting through ignorance and duality. So, you know, that a little bit of description there about him. And the translation here is Great Wisdom Manjushri Bodhisattva in our chanting book. The second one, Samantabhadra, is translated in our chanting book, Great Action Universally Good Bodhisattva. So, there's some description about him. You know, again, it wasn't a very long entry, and it was a little bit hard for me to get a sense of sort of when you think about Samantabhadra, or in Korean, Hei Bo Hyon Bosa. But then we come to Avalokitesvara. And that, I have quite a lot of stuff here because there was quite a lot of stuff written. Kwannon Bosal, Avalokitesvara Bodhisattva, is by far the most popular bodhisattva in popular Buddhist religion. And takes many forms. Interestingly, about sort of the name translation, we often use this second the spelling on that, so the page that starts with the Avalokitesvara here, there's a spelling. I've put the names in Chinese, Japanese, and Korean, and then it says Avalokitesvara with the A-S-V-A-R-A ending. And then there's this other form, which is the E-S with the accent mark. So I guess that's a sh kind of sound. So Avalokiteshvara versus Avalokitesvara. And from what I was reading about that, the first one is probably earlier, and it really is more true to the translation that we use, which is the Perceive World Sound Bodhisattva. The other translation kind of suggests this Lord Bodhisattva looking down type image, and there was an observation in what I was reading that seems to be sort of a reintegration of some of the Hindu concepts. And not necessarily the original idea. So that was kind of interesting stuff. There's a whole lot written about, in Chinese, Kuan Yin, or in here it's Guan Yin. So you see these different Chinese spellings. That, you know, I don't know if everybody knows that there was this big transition in how we anglicize Chinese words in the kind of in around 1980, I think it was, from going from this Wade Gillis system to the Pinyin system. So that's Peking became Beijing, and all this change happened in terms of how these are rendered. So that's why you'll see things spelled differently depending on how old they are often. But Guanyin, described extensively in the Lotus Sutra. So a lot of the very religious forms of, well, I'm going to make that distinction, these kind of more devotional forms of Mahayana Buddhism, such as the Pure Land School and that sort of thing, that really have an emphasis on devotion to and kind of a worshipful stance of Guanyin Bodhisattva in particular, and the Buddhas, and this idea of another Pure Land somewhere else that we would all hope to get to when we perfect ourselves in Buddhism. And it's all Mahayana Buddhism. So I was thinking a lot about sort of how is Zen a part of that or related to that. It does seem like Zen always tries to keep forefront the standard of whatever it is. It's got to be right here and right now. How do we understand all this in terms of it being right here and right now? And so that really changes how we understand it. I think this sort of the idea of original, the original teachings of the Buddhism, the Buddha being kind of austere, and then some of the more elaborate forms of Mahayana Buddhism really struck some people, Westerners, as a huge contrast. So there was this Russian scholar in 1927 who said the following about his astonishment about this. And it's a little bit long, but bear with me. He says, and I think he really liked his own idea of what the original Buddhism was. When we see an atheistic, soul-denying, philosophic teaching of a path to personal final deliverance consisting in an absolute extinction of life and a simple worship of the memory of its human founder, he kind of likes that, actually. When we see it superseded by a magnificent high church with a supreme god surrounded by a numerous pantheon and a host of saints, a religion highly devotional, highly ceremonious and clerical, with an ideal of universal salvation of all living creatures, a salvation by the divine grace of Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, a salvation not in annihilation, but in eternal life. We are truly justified in maintaining that the history of religions has scarcely witnessed such a break between new and old within the pale of what nevertheless continues to claim common descent from the same religious founder. So, these streams probably developed without. It probably was not that remarkable how that developed. I don't know, and I don't know that much about early Buddhism. And it doesn't seem like the early Buddhist teachings really challenged that much the existing kind of Hindu religious order. It just had more concern about day-to-day the day-to-day human path, but it didn't become a huge religious conflict at that point. And so I guess it's not surprising that some of the types the cosmology, the ideas about all these deities and saints and things like that might have been popular in Hinduism sort of continued along in Buddhism to some extent. I don't know if anybody else has any thoughts about that. I'd be interested in hearing that. So we chant Quantsay and Bosal over and over again, and what is the function of that? So I don't think that we're trying to summon Avalokiteshvara to come and save us, or save the people whose names are on the altar on our behalf. I really appreciated a teaching, Zhangji, that you gave once right before we did special chanting. And I believe what you said was that when you chant, think about if you have somebody in mind that you're wanting to chant for who's suffering, think about and keep that person in mind as you chant. If you don't have anybody in particular in mind as you're chanting, just keep the spacious awareness and do the chanting. I found that very helpful. To think about sort of then what is the function of sort of chanting the name of this identity that has to do with compassion, great love, great compassion, hearing the suffering sounds of the world. If we're not trying to, that whatever is here with us is already here with us. So it really is about sort of how do we sort of rouse that compassion within us and together. The idea of that maybe that this this bodhisattva energy exists within us and among us in a way. There's these ideas that may be a little bit more modern ideas about interbeing or kind of group mind in terms of I think once we start to challenge the idea that our own identities are real, then we're kind of free to sort of draw identities across ourselves as people. And this exercise to try to increase our capacity for hearing and seeing, witnessing suffering and responding to it seems like a good idea. I mean, if it works. I know that we haven't done it for a long time, but doing this, the Quantsay and Bosal chant for a long period of time is described as a keto retreat, and I'm not sure what the origins of that are, but it's always described as something that sort of helps raise energy, and I think it's supposed to be compassionate energy. The other chant we do, and the fourth bodhisattva in this list, Siddhagarbha or Jijan Bonsai. Responsibility for the instruction of all beings in the six worlds, in the air between the parinirvana and of the Buddha and the rise of Maitreya. So that's now. And he's seen as the savior of souls who have to suffer in the underworld. We have a 49-day ceremony after someone dies. I think that sort of the usual explanation of that is that there's this period after someone dies where their soul, which we've decided that we're not sure that we have one, but the soul sort of has to come to terms with the fact that they're not alive anymore, and then they can be reborn after they've acknowledged that they're no longer alive. But this idea of, you know, if we go to this idea of interbeing, that all of us exist partly within each other, as well as having this sort of home in our own experience. When one of our bodies dies, then there's still this part that's still present in other people. And so if we do that chant, I think we have the opportunity to sort of let that go and recognize that person's body is gone and they're not coming back in the same way. That was the only idea I came up with, is how that chant functions for us. They're not doctrine, these chants. The repeating of Avalokiteshvara's name in various forms, Om Mani Padme Hum, is another way of that very popular mantra chant. They are kind of very popular in sort of the more religious schools, as I was saying. And then we learned when we were talking about Korean Buddhism last year that our school is a little bit more integrated in terms of some of the other Mahayana forms, and maybe incorporates that to a bit more extent than other types of Zen school. But I mean, I'd be happy to hear or have any kind of discussion about people's thoughts about sort of this religious aspect of what we do. And I know that sort of stirred up some thoughts or controversy before, and not just with you, Nate, but at other times, there's been interesting discussions about is Zen a religion, and are some of these forms religious, and other practices, completely pragmatic in some ways, and is there a difference? Is religion a pragmatic human institution? And if so, how?
I guess I would like to say I grew up in a culture where we celebrate 7 days after death and 40 days after death and 1 year. And you mentioned 49 days. So I'm just wondering where those numbers come from.
Well, that is a good question. And the way things are kind of paralleled across the world and across religions is very fascinating, too. I mean, there's been a lot of observation about how Kuan Yin is often depicted as male or female, and and parallels with the way Mary in the Catholic faith has been depicted have been observed. There's all kinds of folk religions as well. I don't know where the 49 days comes from in Buddhism, or how old that tradition is, if it's Buddhist or predates that, or because that sounds very close to 40 or 7 plus 40.
Yeah, 49. I believe the 49 days is the same in Chinese folk religion. I know that my mother-in-law, every day she would light a candle to Guanyin and offer, have the offering of rice and oranges. And this but she didn't, she was not Buddhist or anything. This was just sort of the folk religion of southern China. And they also, when my father-in-law and my mother-in-law died, there was the 49-day ceremony. This is in Vancouver, in the Chinese community there. So it seems to be, rather than a Buddhist thing, more a, at least from that experience, more a Eastern Asian, Chinese type folk thing. I know that a lot of, you know, Jizhang, Jizhou's, what I always name it as, but Guanyin, Jizhou, they're very much a part of that whole, it's not even necessarily, it's sort of mythological folk understanding in China and Japan.
Interesting, and we know that a whole lot of Buddhism was reinvented in some ways as it was translated into China. Is it the Lotus Sutra that describes kind of the expedient means and using whatever, you know, using the forms that people can relate to? To get teaching points across.
I kind of just figured 49 days was, you know, it's been over a month and a half.
They're not coming back.
Yeah.
No. Sure.
I understand it as the bardos of death, but I really don't know how the bardos of death is 49 days.
What, one thing that I know in just general terms is that every culture on Earth has a kind of numerology. There's a kind of religion of numbers. Judaism is certainly a case in point. So too with Buddhism. So then number 9 is number 7. Three is very important. But that's you know, I can't speak to it more than that, that there's a kind of, maybe it's tied to the kind of tradition of oral learning, that the numbers, that all those numbers of things is just another way of remembering and categorizing and scheduling. For them.
7 weeks.
Yeah.
It is. It's an auspicious number, 108. You might be familiar with. We used to do 108 vows every day. So, in picking up on what you're saying, 108 is an important number in Buddhism, and 49. I don't know the details of it, but it is 7 weeks, and I think it does come out of pre-Buddhist practices.
Is this also a time before they had watches? So I figured if it's a lunar-based society, it's easy to keep track of time.
Yeah, I was thinking that too, because I was looking at the calendar and I seen that the full moon and the new moon were separated by approximately 3 weeks. So if you started with a new moon, went to another new moon, and then to the full moon, that would designate 7 weeks from a lunar calendar, from using the elements surrounding the four clocks.
And going back to the chanting, another thing that I didn't mention before is there's this function that music has in our lives in terms of the feeling of rhythm, this connection of thought and feeling with sound in a way that sort of helps organize all that. So you could certainly say that there's sort of a, you know, a pragmatic function to any of this without having to resort to any of the divine references.
I really appreciate you writing the different translations of the names, you know, in Sanskrit and then in Chinese, Japanese, and Korean. So I don't read a lot of Chinese, but I happen to be able to read those three characters, and it makes so much sense to me now. Because for Avalokiteshvara, the characters, one. So, Guan Yin, so the character Guan, the way I think of that character is to perceive, and Yin is sound. And then the other one you wrote is Guan Zizai, that one I would translate it to perception, self. So that is all that I really need.
Wow, I'm glad I left those in. I can't take credit for writing them. I just copied them and left them in.
Yeah.
And that, you know, Sung Sam's Kwannon school. So Kwannon is another name for Kuan Yin. Mm-hmm. That's actually the direct translation, I think. This perceived sound.
The question I have is, how important is it when we're doing the chanting to think of the meaning of the words in the chant as opposed to just experiencing the sound and the kind of physical sensation and the community part of it?
I would say probably more the latter. I mean, you can certainly weigh in on that, but I did some reading that some of the Japanese chants, even though they're sort of in the Japanese syllables, if you're an American student learning Japanese chants, those are kind of from trying, sort of meant to, they're like we do, they were meant to copy medieval Chinese, and the Japanese, even though that from a Westerner you're thinking, okay, I'm chanting in Japanese, it's not really comprehensible to most Japanese who are chanting those. It's what I was reading. So.
From my experience in the Japanese Pure Land, that's absolutely true. The characters, they're written in Chinese characters, and they usually have the Japanese phonetics, but the native Japanese speakers, it's not comprehensible.
It's like Latin.
I think it's an important question that you bring up, because it can affect people very differently. And when I first started practicing in the 70s with Zen Master, his response to that question was, it doesn't matter, just chant 100%. But we were completely naive. We knew nothing about what we were chanting. And in fact, you know, I've been doing these chants for 40 years, and it wasn't until Paul's talk on the Great Dharani that I actually had an inkling of really what I was chanting. And I appreciate it. So I think there's a balance. We have to appreciate that we come out of a Western culture for which all of this is very foreign. It was the Zen Master Sun Tzu was steeped in. I think at this point in my life, I think both, but to be caught by the meaning is problematic. To be informed.
Nicely said, but just to be informed by the meaning. I mean, when we pra- prostrate ourselves at homage to the three jewels. We do it with reverence because we're bowing down to the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. But our focus in Zen is not so much the devotional of looking outwardly towards a Buddha. We bow down to the Buddha, but we're trying to find and manifest this nature in ourselves so that we can manifest it in the world. So it's, again, it's somewhere in between. That's a great question.
Another thing that's, one of my earlier impressions of Zen practice, and this was with the, a Japanese group, was that the idea was that you really just focused on attaining that whatever emptiness, spacious awareness, some sort of experience of the goal of enlightenment in some way, and then that would produce this compassionate action, that would be spontaneous. And so this always, this struck me coming here as that this was a lot more intentional in trying to produce, to generate compassion. And in terms of, I didn't get that far with that group to really talk about precepts or anything like that. But the whole thing about precepts and a system of ethical behavior, and then working to be a more compassionate person, seemed like a different type of project in some ways, or a different emphasis on how to. How to exert faith in the practice.
And I've kind of pondered a little bit, you know, when we're chanting and people read names or say names. I kind of wondered about that. And, coming from a Christian tradition and the Psalms and their specific words and so, I know I've asked teachers at various times, like when I'm singing Kwansin Bolsol and holding someone in my thoughts, it's not like, I don't know, I've struggled between, it's like, is that prayer? We don't really pray, I guess, just kind of. And then I think you touched on something that made me think of the collective unconsciousness, kind of the group. What did you say? Something about
interbeing group.
Yeah. So then I thought, well, who knows? You know, maybe they're perceiving this energy or something. I don't know. I don't have any thoughts on that. I mean, there's been a couple times when I've been, people close to me have been in the active process of dying, and I, chanted and Kwansin Bolsol, and one time I just really felt like I was making a connection, and the other time I really didn't. I felt like, oh, I was just saying words. I guess it's all the intention behind it. But it's just, to me, it's kind of like there's don't know in there when I do that.
That's the way I think about that, just simply is that I don't expect that energy to kind of go to that person, but if I'm going to have interactions with that person, that can be hard if they're really suffering, to really be open to that and feeling like I have support from the community, that kind of strength from the community maybe makes that more possible, makes it easier to be open when I than with that person who is suffering.
I've had the same thoughts. When, in particular, there's the Pulse nightclub. I think, shooting a couple years back. We did Kijang Gosal chanting that night. Like, what are we actually doing? What does this accomplish? And if nothing else, it's just kind of holding those people in your thoughts. And just that intention of really remembering and kind of paying homage to that, I mean, for me, anyway.
Yeah, I
like how Jill phrased it. Because in Christianity, there are different thinking sort of levels of spirituality where, you know, a prayer is meant to bring that to the person suffering, right? And if that's your belief, that's your belief, and it's hard to convince you otherwise. And then there's the other side that says, well, no, it's more about changing us, right? But you ended with the don't know. Good, where it's, well, is it that dualistic, perhaps? I don't know. So,
Yeah, I agree. You know, we practice the Zen thing, and things are just as they are, you know, without, maybe without individual identity, right? Giver, receiver, or one. Comes to thinking, but the Avalokiteshvara, you know, Teshvara or whatever, I think of the Bodhisattva maybe as, you know, bringing math as a summation or an aggregation of all kindness occurring at this moment, you know. I picture that as a live, you know, rippling kind of thing occurring around the world, you know. I mean, there is a summation of, in this moment, kindness occurring everywhere, you know. Somebody's letting somebody merge an i5, right? Probably. and so it's, I guess, nice to feel like you're part of an aggregate of kindness beyond any individual.
But we also can be the aggregate and also the individual. So when you brought Gloria upstairs on Sunday, you were Avalokiteshvara at that moment. We all manifest that characteristic from time to time. Part of our practice is to open ourselves to it more and more for the benefit of whoever and whatever we encounter. And I thought your comment about, you know, instead of thinking, is it going to have an effect on somebody else? What happens to us when we chant Kwan Tsung Boso? What happens to us when we hold the victims of the Pulse Nightclub in our hearts, or people whose names were on there? Compassion opens up as a result of that. Compassion stops becoming a concept and it becomes something much more intimate and direct. That's the way I see this chanting that we do. There's no guarantee of any kind of outcome based on our chanting that we can see. There might be, there might not. But something happens to us as individuals in a group, I think, when we do it.
And we'll let that person merge you into i5.
Yeah. So I appreciate what you said. You were talking about Jill's comments. At the end of what you were saying, you said that to chant is to enter into a non-dual kind of practice. Like, we try to explain. Why are we chanting? What effect does it have? And so we're always making something. Is it working? No. To have it be non-dual too, so let's say in terms of Jijang Gosal chanting.
we invoke someone who we know or who somebody else knows, and then and then just have an intention, which is, well, I guess having an intention is a bit dualistic, but expressing it in a non-dual way, in a way we can't really define. We're chanting now. What does that mean? I don't know. But I wrote it.
Interesting effects about compassion and connections that you mentioned, even about numbers that I mentioned. The grandma of a little girl, 7 years old, was telling me the story. Mom of 7 years old. 7 year old grew up with grandma who died, and somebody told the girl that if we pray for dead, they will go to heaven. So a little girl was praying every day, and then one morning she got up and she said, "Mom, I saw grandma," and she told me, "Thank you." And it was exactly a year of grandma's death. So another story very quick. A member of my family who died, and her friend, called me and she said, 7 days, and I saw the dream that she was telling me, "Come on, come and visit me." Exactly 7 days. A year of death, I had a dream. I was constantly, very often, going to a cemetery and just talking to her, saying, "People are telling me that you're in a better world, and it's just so much I don't understand that I just don't know how it can be. I wish I had an answer." Exactly here, in early in the morning, I see the dream. My daughter's face, satisfied and younger, and very happy. And it scared me. It was exactly a year of death. So, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Thank you for sharing that.
Interesting, scary.
Well, sort of adding on to that, because I come out of a Christian background also, and the prayer of divine intervention or prayer of, sort of offends me personally is the prayers for, not attainment, but anyway,
prayers.
Where I was going to go, what?
Petition.
Petition, not that so much, but the particular people who believe in praying for their own wealth. And benefit.
Oh.
Yes. Whereas at least the community that I was in my sort of philosophy in terms of it was very much that the prayer is not about changing elsewhere, it's about me. It's the, who gave the talk on, who talked about ignorance is ignoring. And that the prayers, like the prayers of the people in the Episcopal tradition, it's a whole litany of, not about me, but about, it starts at a high level of prayers for the earth, prayers for this, then it goes to prayers to community, and then prayers come to see it in the same way of it's not, it is about opening and being more compassionate. But I have to say that don't know, talking about changing, you know, like you're chanting for someone else, well, the chanting is about opening me and connecting me. It's then with those eyes and those or more openness to compassion that I think leads us to either, I mean, in a very direct way, in some cases, take care of that friend who's sick or dying, or to take care of, you know, to change my behavior about how I treat my earth and whatever. I mean, so it's maybe not directly, like, I'm chanting for this to happen. No, it's about chanting so that I am a part of, what's that little maxim, I'm the change I want to be, or whatever, or something. But I've also, I just was saying, you know, on Sunday I was saying I had been thinking about whether or not to go to a memorial service for someone I didn't even know, but I know the family quite well. And I remarked that I've always felt like funerals and our memorial services and the way we mark these things through the years is not necessarily so much for that person who's passed. I mean, they're not here anymore. It's for us. So I've always felt like it's the, and each culture has these mourning traditions of whether you mourn for 49 days or whether you sit Shiva or you do different things. And for me, I think it's about helping us transition in terms of this person is no longer alive, but those memories, those all those other things that are passed down to us. So I'll finish by saying I don't remember the date or anything, but my grandmother and mother died within 2 years, and I was just bereft at the point. And I mean, I was functioning and everything, but I remember the dream, like it happened yesterday, that kind of flipped a switch. And both my mother and grandmother loved to do needlepoint, you know, so yarn through these little holes. And I woke up one morning in the middle of this whole dream of they were both together, and I'm like, here, we're picking out colors, and my mother and grandmother were together. And so who knows? Things, again, probably mind-making things, but I think part of those traditions are about keeping those people sort of still in our lives or marking those things. I think that's why we mark graves, why we do things like that. But I was going to, the last question I was going to ask though was, we still haven't come back to, is Buddhism a religion versus a pragmatic, and I don't even know what the definition of religion is compared to, is Zen just a practice?
We may not get to the answer to that tonight. I am really happy to sort of like that this sense of that why we chant and the effect that it has on us and that's a wonderful thing. The other thing that I hadn't said is about Kuan Yin, one of these manifestations, the thousand eyes and hands that we have to chant. So I mean, pointing out the obvious that you get 500, maybe a few more than 500 people, you've got 1,000 eyes and hands, that also goes to that group mind thing. That 1,000 eyes and hand chant is interesting. It's got the kitchen sink in there. I noticed that. I think it might be sort of a way of keeping top of mind sort of a lot of our traditions. Not only the Great Dharani, but pretty much our whole precept ceremony is at the end of that chant, I was noticing as well. All in Korean, but looking at these translations is amazing.
Just a thought to add about the thousand eyes and hands is that, to me, it seems a metaphor for spacious awareness. You know, that when we experience that quality, then every pore, every facility is open.
We sense the world without limit, and we're ready to act without limit.
Yes. Yes.
That's all I have as far as presentation.
Thank you, Jean.
Appreciate it. It's been a lot of appreciation for the conversation aspect. It's very nice. We're getting good at that.
Group wisdom.
Yeah.